Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's Monday, February 2nd, and don't forget, this is disaster drill week. So we might have to vacate the premises in a simulated or real emergency. All right, so if that happens, make sure you take all your belongings with you. Proceed out a safe exit, one that is not crumbling down or burning in front of you. So either that door or that door or that door, and proceed to the parking lot where we will have instructions on where to go. So personally, this week I would recommend that each of you bring a cooler and a lawn chair, because you never know when you're going to be let out of class, and then you can entertain yourselves out in the parking lot or baseball field or wherever you end up. Okay. Along that line, instructors have to know who's in class, right, so that the college can be accountable for everybody in case we want to find out, like, the building's collapsing, if somebody's trapped in the building. So here is the sign-in sheet, very important, especially during disaster drill week, to sign in so we know you are here. Plus, it's important for everybody to know, for me to know, that you're in class anyway. So these rosters are current as of today. So everybody that was a no-show should have been dropped. Everybody that has registered for the class should be on that roll sheet. If your name is not on that roll sheet, there's probably a big problem, which we may or may not be able to fix at this point in time. All right, so if your name is not there, make sure you see me after class, and we'll see if there's anything we can do about it. All right. Also, I think the practicum starts this week. So I want to review some things that we looked at last time, and that is the flash quiz on histology. All right, so I'm not going to go real fast this first time. Now, does anybody have any questions before I get going with this thing right here? Before we finish up integument and move on to bones? We're good so far? Okay. I see we haven't switched the light bulb out yet in that thing. All right, so when I show you a picture, tell me what it is. What does that look like? So that looks like mitosis, right? Looks like mitosis to me. Now, what phase of mitosis? You say anaphase. All right, I don't know. It kind of looks like these things are lined up in the middle right here. Are they being pulled? Can you see they're being pulled apart a little bit? Okay. Well, let's come back. I would say metaphase on that one. Hyaline cartilage, because I see these chondrocytes and lacunae, and I don't see any fibers. I just see ground substance. So on the practicum, what would you say? What's the complete name for this? Yeah, hyaline cartilage CT. Your lab instructor might let you get away with CT, right? Maybe, maybe not. Okay, and then this slide right here. All of these are what phase? What phase of the cell cycle? Interphase. These are interphase. I don't see any chromosomes anywhere in any of these cells right here. So that's all these cells are, an interphase. Question? Question, question, question? No? Okay. All right. Now what's this? Now, again, it's mitosis. What stage? That's got to be anaphase, because the chromosomes are being pulled apart, anaphase. So, yeah, these things right here, those are the chromosomes, and these things are the spindle apparatus, and then the centrosome is over here and over here. Okay, so anaphase. What kind of tissue is that? Oh, that's easy. That's bone CT. We see osteocytes inside lacunae. We're going to learn a lot more about that structure, maybe today. Okay, what's this? Basement membrane, connective tissue, simple cuboidal epithelium. Here is the lumen. Blood CT, erythrocyte, lymphocyte, neutrophil. All right, is that kind of ringing a bell? Basement membrane, pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium with a goblet cell. Stratified squamous epithelium, basement membrane, non-keratinized, stratified cuboidal. Here's the lumen, basement membrane, connective tissue, transitional epithelium, areolar CT, adipose CT. Why is this an atypical CT? An atypical connective tissue? Why atypical? Yeah, because there's very little matrix. Most of this tissue is intracellular. There's very little matrix right here. Connective tissue has extensive matrix. But adipose connective tissue, the lipid is inside the cell. All right, so it's sort of an atypical connective tissue. Doesn't have an extensive matrix. What's this? That might be early prophase. I see some of the chromosomes sort of condensing right here. I see centrosome right here. Hi. Dense irregular CT. Reticular CT. Pseudostratified columnar. This is stratified columnar, not pseudostratified. This is stratified columnar. And it's not ciliated. Smooth muscle, terrible picture, but that's the way it goes. Simple columnar. Dense regular CT. Okay, here's a basement membrane. Here's a stratum basale right here, right? Here's the stratum corneum. So this is thin skin, right? Stratified squamous epithelium. Cardiac muscle tissue. And telophase with cytokinesis. You can see the cleavage furrow. The chromosomes are separating. Maybe even the nuclear envelope is starting to reappear. Fibrocartilage, chondrocytes, inside lacunae, collagen fibers, skeletal muscle, tissue. Don't ever say skeletal muscle CT. Don't get carried away. Always think about what you write on your answer sheet, right? It's just skeletal muscle tissue, plain and simple. And this is thick skin. Yeah, you can see the dermal papillae right here, stratum basale right here, stratum corneum, little stratum lucidum right in this area. So this would be a stratified squamous keratinized epithelium because these are all keratinocytes. They have keratin inside them, giving skin, at least the epidermis, their strength. Elastic cartilage. You see chondrocytes inside lacunae and these branched fibers, those are elastic fibers. And then here, this is a good one. This is prophase. You see the condensed chromatin. But, you know, it's not anaphase. You could get tricked into thinking this is anaphase, but notice the chromosomes aren't separating. It's a purely random arrangement in there. The chromosomes are all over everywhere, all over the place. All right? Metaphase. Okay, so now we're going to go really fast. Ready? All right, so that was metaphase. Hyaline cartilage CT. Interphase. Anaphase. Bone CT. I showed you that for way too long a time. Simple cuboidal epithelium. Make sure you say epithelium if it's epithelium. Blood CT. Pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. Stratified squamous, non-keratinized. Stratified cuboidal epithelium. Transitional epi. Looser areolar CT. Adipose CT. Make sure you say CT for adipose. What is that? Prophase. Dense irregular CT. Reticular CT. Stratified columnar epithelium. Smooth muscle tissue. Simple columnar epi. Dense regular CT. Thin skin, yeah, it's stratified squamous epithelium. Cardiac muscle tissue. Telophase with cytokinesis. Fibrocartilage CT. Oh, I went back. Oh, you're going to have to see it one more time. Hope you don't miss that one on the practicum. Fibrocartilage CT. Because all the collagen is what? Collinear arranged. It's not branching as you would see in? Skeletal muscle. But that other, if you see branched fibers in cartilage, that would be what? Elastic. Elastic cartilage CT. Yeah. This right here is skeletal muscle tissue. What other one? This one? Cardiac. Intercalated discs. Branching. Skeletal muscle, no branching. No intercalated discs. No branching, no intercalated discs. So these are what we call fibers because they're long and narrow. All right, maybe one more?
Thick skin.
Ah, that was elastic cartilage. And this one here is prophase of mitosis. I need an extra blank slide in there. Okay. All right, so that is metaphase. All right. You guys want to see that again after class? Maybe you could stick around for the break or something if you want to see it one more time. Okay, but maybe not right now, okay? Because I'm getting seasick watching it. Oh, I know. Okay, let's finish up with the integumentary system. Don't forget, what makes up the integument? It is skin and accessory structures. And what are the accessory structures? Hair, nails, glands, and a little bit of muscle. And the model that you have in lab is really excellent to show all these things. All right, so I don't know if I'm going to show you much in the way of pictures right here, but hair is just a thread-like structure consisting of columns of dead epithelial cells. And what is the chemical inside epithelial cells that give the epithelium strength? Is it A, melanin? Is it B, collagen? Is it C, elastin? Or D, keratin? Or E, gold? Oh, it is keratin, right? It's keratin. All right, so keratin is a chemical compound that makes hair even stronger than your skin. All right, the shaft of the hair lies above the surface of the skin. The root and the bulb are below the surface. And the hair follicle is just a deep invagination of the epidermis. It's a reservoir of epidermal cells. Oh, I do want to talk about this a little bit. Okay, hair color is a function of the amount and color of melanin. Red hair is a result of melanin plus a little bit of iron incorporated into it. All right, so this is a pretty important statement right here. Reservoir of epidermal cells. Let me go find the integument slides. That's not them. Okay. Before I can talk about that. What chapter is that? 5? Close. Right here. All right. Let's just talk about burns for just a little bit and how that relates to this particular tissue right here. We talked about injury to the epidermis, and if you injure the epidermis, does it bleed?
No.
Why? How come it doesn't bleed? Are you sure? Because epithelium or any kind of, an epithelium, including the epidermis, doesn't contain blood vessels. Right? And let's zoom in. I'm going to have to zoom into this region right here. Okay, like that. I lose my arrow, but that's the way it goes. What can you tell me about the cells right up here, the most superficial cells of the epidermis? They're dead. That's right. All right, so if you get a burn and you burn some of these cells right in the stratum corneum, that's not a very big deal, right? Because they're designed to slough off, and the epidermis is designed to replace them very easily. So what is the most living layer of the epidermis? the stratum basale, which is way down over here. Okay, so can you see it waving around through all these dermal papillae? And it even then, when it bumps into a hair follicle, it helps make this sebaceous gland. And then the stratum basale does what? It goes all the way deep down into almost all the way through the dermis. And clinically, that's really important for burn patients. So let's discuss that. And here you can see that little erector pili muscle right here. All right, so if somebody gets a first-degree burn, these papillary plexes right here get a little swollen. There's a little bit of leakage of plasma from the blood, and you have enhanced blood flow through these areas, so your skin looks a little puffy and looks a little red. Right, a first-degree burn might damage some of the nerve endings up over here, pain nerve endings, and will feel a little bit uncomfortable. But that person is, what, really lucky that they didn't sustain any kind of more serious burn. Yeah? Yeah, that's the next kind of burn. That's what we call a second-degree burn. All right, a second-degree burn is a little bit more severe. So not only do you damage the stratum corneum, you might damage some of the deeper layers of the epidermis right here, and these capillaries now start to leak a lot of plasma, right? And when they leak plasma, that's what forms a blister in that area. Okay, so that's a second-degree burn. That's what you're asking about. How do you get that blister? That's more severe. All right, and then, but is that person still pretty lucky? You would say, yeah, because it's a little bit painful, but you're going to recover just fine from that kind of burn. All right, now what about a third-degree burn? That's the most serious kind, a third-degree burn. Maybe even the stratum corneum is just turned to charcoal, all right? It's burned away, and that burn goes all the way through the epidermis, even killing these stratum basale cells. And if these stratum basale cells are, so let's just say that somebody burns themselves all the way down to this layer right here, kills all of those cells. So now that stratum basale in this region of the skin, they're gone. So what does that mean? That means that this part of the skin can't regenerate, right? Because those cells that are reproducing by mitosis, the skin cells right there, they're gone, they're dead. All right, so is that an unlucky person or a lucky person? Okay, you might say unlucky, and I want to change your opinion a little bit. Okay, I would say that person is still lucky if they get burned to this level right here, because trace around this stratum basale. Where does it go? It bumps into a hair follicle, and where does it go? Deep down into the dermis right here. So if somebody has a third-degree burn down to this level, at least they still have stratum basale cells that can regenerate the skin because of that hair follicle right there. Oh, okay, I'll talk about next. That's next. You always ask these good questions that lead into my next topic. But someone else had a question over here.
I just have a question when you're talking about the blister.
Yeah?
What did you say that the fluid inside the blister?
That's plasma. That's leaking out of these blood vessels right here.
Okay.
Right? They start to get leaky because they're damaged. And that's one way that your body tries to fight infection and repair the damage for that burn. Okay. So if somebody's burnt to this layer right here, I think they're still lucky because those reservoir cells of the stratum basale right here, all right, still can regenerate skin in this area. All right, as long as, what do we have to do for the patient? When somebody loses, all right, the major part of their integument, what are the two things, what functions are lost that you have to be really careful of? Infection, that's right, because bacteria now can take advantage of all of these living tissues down over here. There's no barrier for protection any longer. And another thing happens too. Okay, the other thing is dehydration, because the epidermis, remember, prevents you from turning into a potato chip. And if you lose that epidermis, you'll lose a tremendous amount of fluid. Okay, so dehydration is the second most important concern. And then it's going to take a long time for these cells to regenerate, all right? But at least this person is lucky. Now, what happens if somebody gets a third-degree burn all the way down past the bulb of this hair follicle right here, the root of the hair follicle? Is that a lucky or unlucky person? That's really unlucky because there are no longer any living stratum basale cells in that area of their skin at all. It will never regenerate on its own, no matter how long you give it. So what do they need then? Then they need a graft, right? Then they need an auto transplant. Hopefully there's a spot on their body that wasn't burned that they can harvest skin from and transplant it to these other locations, right? But that takes time to grow that skin. So probably in the meantime, they have to be covered with a donor integument, maybe from a pig or something like that, right? So that's the importance of this hair follicle. Not only does this hair provide for insulation and sensation, right, but it also provides a nice reservoir for these healthy stratum basale cells. So that, I think, is pretty important to appreciate. Muscles that erect or pillate just causes the hair to stand on end, gives you those goosebumps. And then here we got some glands, right? We've got two major kinds of glands, sebaceous glands and sweat glands. The sebaceous glands are always associated with another accessory structure. What's another accessory structure that a sebaceous gland is going to be associated with? It's a hair follicle. So you only see sebaceous glands around the hair follicle, and it's the job of that sebaceous gland to produce sebum. That's an oil. So that helps lubricate the skin, and don't forget that oil prevents dehydration as well, and it protects against some bacteria. So that's a normal function of sebum. Sweat glands, on the other hand, sometimes we call these sudoriferous glands. We got two different kinds, actually maybe a number of different kinds, two major kinds of sweat glands, merocrine, and these you saw in the picture because they have a tube that opens up to the surface of the skin, and when these glands secrete something, it's mostly water, a little bit of salt, and that water then evaporates from the surface of your skin that cools the person down for maintaining body temperature so that you don't overheat. All right, some sodium and chloride are secreted as well, and those are ions. They have an electrical charge, so they can carry electrical current over the surface of your skin. As far as I know, that's not so important biologically or physiologically, but it can be measured, for instance, in a lie detector test. So if you're a normal person and someone asks you a question and you mislead somebody, guess what your sweat glands do? They start to secrete sweat, which secretes salt onto the surface of your skin, and a lie detector machine can detect that salt by measuring an increase in conductivity on somebody's skin. That's actually fun to do in a physiology lab, to measure somebody's galvanic conductance on their skin. Okay, another kind of gland is an apocrine gland. That's a sweat gland. It's a modified sweat gland. These are open to hair follicles and the axilla. Where's the axilla at? Armpit. Genitalia. That's your inguinal region. All right, and external ear. These secrete organic secretions, and these are not odoriferous in themselves, but since they're organic, other organisms can use them as an energy source, and body odor is a result of bacterial action on some of these secretions, where in the axilla, in the inguinal region, and in the external ear. There's another gland, another modified sweat gland in the ear. It's called the ceruminous gland, and it secretes cerumen into the external ear canal. We're going to find out where that is, but your external ear canal, you can almost put your little fingers inside your external ear canal right there, and when you pull your finger out, what do you find? You see earwax. You can't hear it. You see it. And that's what we call cerumen. All right? And cerumen acts as an agent that prevents dehydration of your eardrum or tympanic membrane. So it prevents that tympanic membrane from drying out. It should stay nice and moist and pliable because it has to vibrate back and forth when sound pressure hits it. And if it was very dry and start to crack, right, then it wouldn't vibrate back and forth and you wouldn't hear anything. So the ceruminous gland is important for maintaining the health of the eardrum or tympanic membrane. And even mammary glands are sweat glands, but they're modified not to secrete water and salt, but, okay, milk, for instance, lactose, some proteins and antibodies for nursing an infant. All right, then our last thing to look at are nails. Okay, so are nails harder or softer than hair? They're harder. So guess what nails have more of?
Keratin.
Yeah, they're loaded with keratin, right? But they're basically just like cells that make up your skin, except those cells have even more keratin in them. All right, so they're stratum corneum cells filled with hard keratin. Let's see if I can find a picture. Your book does an okay job with a nail. Ah, here's a nail. Oh, it does a really good job. Okay, I like this picture. Okay, so here you can see the nail plate. So here's the tip of the finger, right? And this is the free edge of the nail. This is the part that you cut all the time. It grows out. So here's the body of the nail, or the nail plate. And underneath that is a nail bed, and that's fairly vascular. So if you look through somebody's nail, you can see probably looks a little pink, right? So there's blood flowing through this area. And then here is the cuticle, otherwise we call that the epimysium. That's just a flap of skin. And then the proximal nail fold and the nail plate goes underneath the proximal nail fold, and the part of the nail that's underneath the nail fold right here is what we call the root of the nail. That you can't really see, right? But where do you think a plant grows from? Its roots. But a nail doesn't really grow from its root. A root is really made up of dead cornified cells. Where a nail grows from is really the nail matrix, the most proximal end of the nail underneath the nail fold right here. Why is it the root? Because it's buried in the proximal nail fold, so you can't really see it. So it's more like a root of a plant, with that you can't see a root of a plant. But it's not really growing from the root. The living cells are here in the matrix. And that's a highly vascularized area. So you can damage a nail, right? And it can fall off. And as long as you don't damage the nail matrix, guess what's going to happen to that nail? It's going to grow back. Right, I don't know how long it's going to take, maybe 3 months or so, and it will grow back. But if you damage that nail matrix, burn or whatever, then the nail is not ever going to grow back. Yeah.
Like, you know when you, step on
your
nail or something, it turns black?
Yeah.
Does that mean that the nail matrix is
gone? Well, the nail matrix might bleed a little bit, but look at the nail bed right here. That's highly vascular. There are blood vessels in there, tiny blood vessels. And when you smack your nail, they start to bleed, and those red blood cells then bleed underneath the nail, and those red blood cells will turn different kinds of colors. They'll turn kind of blue and black and maybe yellow or green, different kinds. Like if you have a black eye, you know, it goes through all those different kinds of colors. Same thing with through your nail. You can see through your nail to some degree. Okay, so it's going to bleed under there. If the bleeding is severe, then somebody might actually have to release the pressure a little bit by drilling a little hole through the nail to release some of that pressure. Okay? But for instance, if you ever have a blister due to a burn or a blister on your foot because of exercise, or if you hit your nail and it turns a little bit of a color, it's always best first not to break that blister or to cause the nail to come off. You like to have some kind of healing process right here first. So, because if you have a burn with a blister, that blister still is preventing bacteria from getting into your skin, right? So leave those structures alone for as long as you can. All right, so I would only let a practitioner do something with that nail after you damage it. For instance, if it hurts really bad because pressure is building up, then maybe you need to release that pressure. But it's best to leave that nail alone. All right, so what part of the nail does it grow from? The matrix, right? And the matrix is different than the matrix in connective tissue, right? So you just have to be familiar with that term and know how to apply it in different circumstances. All right, so that's pretty much it for the integumentary system, I think. Oh, wait, we did talk about skin color. Oh, functions of the integument. Oh, I guess we're not quite done, but we're almost done. Okay, function, we talked about this at the very beginning of this chapter. Protection, it prevents water loss. Very important. I can't say it's the most important, but it's one of the most important. Protection also because it keeps out bacteria and viruses from gaining access to your body. I don't know, do you remember there was that hurricane in New Orleans called Katrina, and everything flooded terribly and sewage backed up all over the place, and right away people were saying, oh, there's going to be this big, terrible outbreak of disease and diphtheria and things like that, and it never really happened, even though people were walking through the water all the time, you know, terribly contaminated water. Can you explain why there weren't very many people that came down with terrible diseases, even though the water was just loaded with sewage and things like that? Because? Yeah, their integument was intact, right? And so that dirty, filthy water with bacteria really couldn't get access to their body. Unless maybe they had a laceration or something, then it probably got infected. So your integument does a marvelous job of keeping bacteria out of your body. What about who?
Cavity.
I'm sorry?
Cavity. That was the way that the water can get cavities.
Body cavities.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, like for Katrina, well, probably nobody was really drinking that water or swimming in it because then it would get in your nose and your ears. That would be really bad. Okay? Yeah, that would be really, really bad. That's why around here, after a storm, what do they put on the beaches around here, these big signs that say... Yeah, don't enter the water. Don't go surfing or whatever because there's a high bacterial count. So your skin is good, but if you're surfing, you get water just swishing through your nose and ears and things like that. Right? Yeah. Oh, the small pores in your skin? You know, that those are so small, they do a really good job of keeping things out. Plus, I think because you sweat so much, even though you don't really notice it, you're always flushing those pores out. So there's... If a bacteria starts to get in one of those pores, it gets flushed out before it gets into your body. Okay? So, So sweating is excellent for you. Yeah. Sweating is really good that way. Okay? And then melanin. What's it good for? It blocks the harmful effects of the sun. All right? Hair is real important. It's for protection. Right, it's a heat insulator. Eyebrows and eyelashes protect your eyes, keep foreign bodies from damaging your eyeballs. You have hair in your nose and ears, and again, that prevents dust and debris and insects even from getting into those orifices. And nails are important for protecting the tips of your fingers and toes, and also for self-defense. We don't do that so much anymore, thank goodness. Okay, but maybe you have some dogs or cats at home, and of course they use those for defense all the time. The skin is also important for temperature regulation, right? So blood vessels in your skin vasodilate when you're hot, so your body takes heat from the interior parts, takes it to your skin, and it radiates away, or maybe through evaporation of sweat that cools you down. And when you're cold, blood vessels in the skin vasoconstrict, and that maintains your body temperature. So the heat in your body doesn't go to your skin, or you cover up. You're freezing. Okay, I wish I had some gloves with me I would give you. Okay, when your core body temperature is above 98.6, your dermal blood vessels are they vasoconstricted or vasodilated? Okay, because what's 98.6? That's your normal body temperature, and if it's above that, you're overheated, so your dermal blood vessels will dilate to help get rid of that extra heat. Yeah.
What is vasoconstriction?
Oh, yeah, vasoconstriction. If you have a tube, like a blood vessel, okay, the amount of blood flow going through that tube is going to be dependent on the diameter of a blood vessel. So I'm showing you a diameter. When the diameter dilates, it gets bigger. More blood can go through it. When a blood vessel gets smaller, we say vasoconstricts, less blood can go through that blood vessel. All right, so just maybe just think of a straw or something when you sip a drink. And sometimes you get a drink with a little tiny little straw that's mostly used for stirring, but it has a hole going right through it, but it's only about as big as a pin. And did you ever try to suck anything through that kind of straw? Well, it would take you all week to drink your drink, because fluid doesn't flow through that straw very well. But if it's a regular big-sized straw, no problem. Okay, also another function, vitamin D production. Your skin should be subjected to some ultraviolet light that produces an inactive form of vitamin D, which can be used by your liver to make an active form of vitamin D. And vitamin D is important for absorbing calcium and phosphate from your diet. And calcium, of course, you know, is important for bones. And we're going to see phosphate's also important for bones as well. But calcium and phosphate are important for other kinds of functions in your body as well. So you need the right amount of sun, or you should take vitamin pills that have vitamin D. But vitamin D is a vitamin you can overdose on, so you have to be a little bit careful. You can't just eat a whole bottle of vitamin D. Okay, and then, of course, sensation. Your skin is important for communicating with your environment, right, in terms of temperature, pressure, vibration. Like sometimes when somebody wants to get your attention, what do? Yeah, well, those would be using your eyes. But hasn't anybody ever tapped you on the shoulder? Here. Right, that's communication even with your skin. Okay. All right. Oh, aging. Okay. I think this last thing I'll just say about aging. Most of the age-related effects on the skin are a result of decreased vascularity, a decreased blood flow going to the skin. And that's just something that automatically happens. As we get older, we lose blood supply to the skin. And something else that contributes to that is ultraviolet radiation damages the blood supply to the skin. So going out in the sun is probably one of the most damaging things you can do to your skin without sun protection. All right, so when blood vessels disappear from your skin, they then start to miss some of the oxygen and nutrients that those cells need to stay alive. So the skin becomes thinner and more transparent, which means what? Thinner, that means it's more easily damaged because there's a decreased collagen in the dermis. So even the dermis is more easily damaged. And with less blood supply, it takes longer to heal. Right, like if you have a grandma or grandpa in their 80s or something and they cut themselves, notice that they cut themselves very easily and they might have that cut for a couple of weeks, maybe even 3 weeks before it heals up. And that's because of that blood supply. Decreased elastic fibers and lipid causes the skin to sag and to wrinkle. Decreased activity of sweat glands and sebaceous glands because they're missing what? Blood supply. Produce dry skin. And also poor temperature regulation. Elderly people have very poor temperature regulation as a result of that. Probably maybe about 10 years ago now, maybe not quite so long, I remember Europe in August, end of July, August, had a heat wave where the temperature went way up into the 90s in France. And there were about 10,000 people that died of heat stroke just because the temperature went up for about a week and a half. And what happened was that it was mostly elderly people because it doesn't hardly ever get that hot in Europe, so nobody had air conditioners. And also during that period of time, almost nobody works. Everybody goes on vacation. So the families left town, left their grandparents alone in the house, and no one was taking care of them, and they just died of heat stroke, which was amazing. It's just a tremendous amount of people died as a result. Mostly what? Elderly people. Decreased vascularity may result in either an increase or decrease of melanocytes. So as you get older, how does your skin get in terms of color? Blotchy, right? You get just blotches growing up, different all over the place, right? And your hair turns gray or white, a result of decreased melanocyte function in the follicle because there are some of those, where are those follicles at? Okay, because those follicles, see these little blood vessels going up into the follicles, their function is compromised. The hair follicle doesn't get as much blood supply, and those melanocytes, all right, sort of give up the ghost and can't produce melanin. So as that hair follicle grows, it's not going to have any pigment or melanin in it. All right, so those are some of the age-related effects on the skin. So if you wanted to come up with a way to maintain youthful skin, right, what would be a good approach to that? What is the underlying cause? What is a problem that you have to solve? Yeah, make sure that the blood supply is maintained or stimulated to grow. You can put all kinds of lotions and salves and all kinds of treatments.
I have a question. When people get like Botox and that stuff, where are they injecting
collagen? Oh, okay, let's talk about that a little bit. Okay. There are muscles underneath this cutaneous layer right here. So when somebody gets Botox, it's not affecting their integument at all. But when a muscle underneath the skin contracts, it's going to pull the skin closer together, and that's going to form a wrinkle. Okay, so in a couple weeks, we're going to start learning about some facial muscles, for instance. And what Botox does, Botox comes from a bacteria, and it poisons the muscle so that they can't contract. And if they can't contract, then it doesn't produce that wrinkle, so those wrinkles have a tendency to disappear. So I suppose if somebody wanted to meditate to learn how to relax all those facial muscles without a Botox injection, then that would probably work just as well. Usually you recover from that Botox injection, so depending on the person, it has to be a repeat injection of that poison. It doesn't really have anything to do, it's the muscles underneath that get poisoned so they don't contract. So, but remember, facial muscles are really important for communication. Right, so if you poison those muscles, then you can't tell what somebody's thinking. Right, they're just looking at you. Yeah. Botox. Botox is actually a poison that prevents those muscles from contracting that are underneath your skin. So, but some people also get augmentation of various surface features, and usually those are collagen shots. All right, so it's a liquefied form of collagen, and so that just kind of puffs your skin up in that area. And, you know, if your skin puffs up, then it has a tendency to also flatten out wrinkles. Okay, so I think mostly those shots are used for augmentation, but it can be used in some circumstances to kind of puff up a wrinkle so that you don't see it. Yeah. The collagen shot is probably not as drastic a surgery or procedure, in my opinion, as Botox, because collagen is a naturally occurring fiber from your body, but Botox is not, and you might actually develop an allergy to that at some point in time. Probably so. Yeah, yeah. It's a foreign substance. Your body will learn how to defeat it eventually. Yeah. Why do people have liver spots? Oh, that's just a decrease in blood supply to that certain spot in their body, and that for some reason that can stimulate the production of melanin, or it can decrease the production of melanin in that one location. And I don't think we really know why that is, but that liver spot is due to that pigment called melanin. Yeah. Ingrown hairs. Maybe because their skin is just too dried out, but there might be some predisposition that some people have for the hair follicle to get trapped within the dermis or epidermis, and then it can get infected if it can't grow out. Yeah. Those infections can be difficult to treat sometimes, because remember, the whole sheath around a hair follicle is epidermis, and there are no blood vessels in epidermis. And in order to get an antibiotic to some part of your body, how do we get an antibiotic to some part of your body? It goes in, yeah, you get a shot, it goes into the blood, and then it takes that antibiotic via the blood to some part of your body. But if you got a part of your body and there's no blood going to it, you can't really deliver that antibiotic there. Yeah, topical maybe works okay a little bit, but in the blood is best. Yeah, in the blood is best. All right, so guess what? That's it for integument system, integumentary system. Yeah. Okay, hold on. I can't hear the question. Hold on, you guys. Yeah? 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 The stratum lucidum in older people, I think, is still there. So thick skin is probably a little bit more resilient to aging because it's thicker. You can afford to lose more before it becomes a problem. But even in older people, I think they probably have to use even more lotion on their hands and even on their feet because of the sebaceous glands and other glands don't lubricate the skin quite so much anymore. Yeah. okay? All right, so let's move on to bone tissue. So I'm going to put integumentary system away. Yeah. Oh, why? What happens to hair a little bit as you grow older? Well, that hair follicle, I didn't put it away right here. See this hair follicle? Has that little blood supply going right into it, right there. And those blood vessels disappear as we get older. Yeah, it happens, just by family history, so it's genetically determined. There are some people whose hair goes gray when they're in their 30s. Other people, it doesn't turn gray until they're 60. So it's just a genetic predisposition that they inherited. Or there might be some environmental influences, too. Okay. And in men, especially, testosterone, there's a form of testosterone that damages these blood vessels, okay, that produces hair loss as well. Now, what I find kind of interesting about the skin, okay, of course, we know that there are some people that produce a lot of melanin in their skin, right? They have very dark skin, and other people don't. And those that don't produce a lot of melanin are very susceptible to sunburn. People with very dark skin are protected from the sun. But nonetheless, as you age, no matter what color your skin is, what happens to your color of your hair? It loses color. It loses melanin. And what I kind of find fascinating is that people with very dark skin, right, as they age, their hair follicles turn white or silver. But what about their skin? Does it ever turn white or silver? No. I find that kind of fascinating. Okay? And why is that? Because it's really these blood vessels that are supplying the hair follicle are damaged more than the subpapillary plexus blood vessels that are supplying the melanocytes on their skin. But I'm sure everybody's skin changes color as we get older. Right? The ones in the hair follicle are the most susceptible to age. Yeah?
If you have more melanin, like the darker
you have, any effect on aging? Yeah, absolutely. Because... yeah, what did I say? What's one of the most damaging things you can do to your skin?
Sun.
Go out in the sun. So the more sunscreen you have, the younger your skin will look as you age, right? So, yeah, this is very true. Unless you put on sunscreen.
Can rubbing your skin, like with lotions and stuff, create more wrinkles and stretch it out?
Can rubbing your skin create wrinkles? You know what? If you rub your skin, it's going to form a callus. So it's going to build up and probably won't form a wrinkle, I don't think. The way you form a wrinkle is actually by wrinkling the skin.
Because I always believe there's too much cream on that it's melting in and made it worse.
I don't know. It really has more to do with blood vessels in the skin.
Good.
So if you could find a cream that would maintain blood vessels, then that would maintain the youthful nature of the skin. But you know what? I don't know of any cream that is actually works on those blood vessels and works as an anti-aging cream. But I tell you what, if you have an idea, let's test it out, because we would make billions of dollars, okay? But instead of spending billions of dollars, how could you protect your skin from aging? Instead of putting all these creams on, you put on sunblock, right, sunscreen. That would protect your skin more than anything. Or a hat. Yeah. Yeah, there are different energies in sun. And not all the products block all of the harmful rays of the sun. So you have to, if you're really interested, you have to educate yourself on what lotion protects your skin from most of the energy coming from the sun. Like there's UVA, UVB, there might be other kinds of UV light as well. Right. Right, right. Oh, guess whose skin is most susceptible to sun damage? Let's take out skin color. Okay. It's going to be, yeah, well, let's take away skin color. Let's erase the effects of melanin. But what kind of people would be most susceptible to sun damage? It's going to be the elderly, okay, as well as infants. Yeah, infants and the elderly. Okay, infants. Who?
You
mean those people who are outside all the time? Living near a beach.
Yeah.
And they're outside all the time?
Well, kind of.
Yeah, they're outside. They wear a hat and sunscreen. Otherwise, you'll damage your skin.
So that's an elderly infant and correcting?
Elderly, yeah.
So infants and elderly.
Infants and elderly, probably most susceptible, yeah. If we don't think about the effects of skin color, yeah. Okay, so we're going to move on to chapter 6. All right, so that takes away our integument chapter. So I don't know, I hope you had some fun learning about the skin in that chapter. Real important to know layers. You know, I forgot to make a specific example of this, but a lot of times in anatomy, students don't like to learn layers of tissues and things like that, but clinically it's very, very important. Just by tracing that stratum basale around a hair follicle determines what? How we treat a patient, what the prognosis is going to be. So knowing layers is very, very important clinically. All right, so the skeletal system. Let's move on to the skeletal system. The components are cartilage, bone, and then some dense regular connective tissue, which are ligaments. All right, so don't forget, cartilage is a connective tissue, bone is a connective tissue, and ligaments are made of a connective tissue, mostly dense regular CT. All right, so those are the components. So let's see where we can find some of these things. All right, let's talk about functions first before I show you a slide. So what are the functions of your skeletal system? Well, support. All right, so right now I'm standing, you're sitting, you have bones holding up your body. I've got a lot of bones holding up my body. So bone is rigid and strong. It can bear great weight because it doesn't compress very much. All right, cartilage, on the other hand, is important for support. Right, it's firm, but it's a little bit flexible. So certain parts of your body that need to have a certain shape or structure, but that structure should bend a little bit, then it can be made out of cartilage. Good examples would be the nose and the ear and the rib cage for expanding your thoracic cavity for when you breathe. And one nice advantage of cartilage, it gives your body a shape, but it's very light compared to bone. If all the cartilage in your body was actually made out of bone, you'd need a lot more food every day, a lot more muscles just to haul that extra bone around. So cartilage is very light compared to bone. Cartilage is also used during development because there are some bones that are actually built out of cartilage before they ossify, before they turn into a hard structure. All right, so cartilage can also act as a precursor or a model for where bones should be in an individual that is developing. Another important function of bone is protection. The skull is protect. What's a skull protecting? The brain. The brain is very soft tissue, very easily damaged. And it's a good thing I have a really hard skull because I'm sure I wouldn't have a brain left anymore if it wasn't really hard, because I've hit my head really hard a number of times. And that protects your brain. Like, you're looking at me funny. Haven't you ever hit your head hard? I remember one time, when I was young, I lived in an apartment building way up on the second floor, so there were a lot of stairs going up to where I lived. And then I think one day one of my neighbors got a refrigerator that came in this big cardboard box. So what's really cool is to take some of that cardboard and go up to the top of the stairs and slide down the stairs with that cardboard. That was a lot of fun, except one time I leaned back a little bit too much and I hit my head on a stair, and I just saw flashes of light everywhere, and I landed on the base of the stairs. But you know, if I didn't have a skull then, my brain just would have been all over the stairs, I'm sure, right? All right, so the skull protects the brain. Rib cage, what does a rib cage protect? Your lungs, your heart, there's huge blood vessels in there, okay, so those protect important vital organs. And the vertebral column, those are bones. They're made out of vertebrae. The vertebral column is made out of vertebrae. That's armor for what part of your body? What's going through? The spinal cord, which is like your brain, right? Except it allows for a little bit more motion. Okay. Skeletal system is important for movement, right? Muscles attached to bones. Two different bones, and when that muscle contracts, it pulls those bones together, and it moves through a joint. All right, so joints occur where bones come together because we don't want bones rubbing on each other. They would grind each other away. What is that condition when somebody's bones actually touch each other at a joint and they grind each other down? That's arthritis. Yeah, a couple different kinds of arthritis. No matter what kind you have, it's bad, right? And then ligaments are bone-to-bone connections to prevent or limit movement. So some bones should be stabilized. They should be held together, and ligaments do that job. So that's a little bit different than a tendon. A ligament is a bone-to-bone connection, and a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection, and tendons really aren't part of the skeletal system. That's part of the muscle system. And bones are also important for storage. They store certain things. They store important ions, calcium, for instance, and inorganic phosphate, which is PO4. These are very important. When you get to take a physiology class, you'll see how these ions are very important all over your body. And bones can also store fat. There are holes inside bones, and those holes are filled with fat, and that's just a storage form of energy inside bones.
So what is the bone marrow?
That's called yellow bone marrow, and it's fat. It's just adipose tissue. Yeah, I'll show you, and I have a slide. I'll show you where that adipose tissue is. So there's adipose, yep, CT on the inside of some bones, and we call that yellow bone marrow. You'll see there are two different kinds of bone marrow. Yellow is one kind. Okay? All right. And then also, bones are very important because that's where blood cells are made, like red blood cells. And we call that hemopoiesis. Hemo has to do with blood. Poiesis is the generation of blood cells. And again, there are cavities in bones that contain the other kind of bone marrow, and that's called red bone marrow for making red blood cells. So those are the two kinds of bone marrow. Yellow, that stores fat or energy. Red, for making red blood cells and platelets. So that's all the functions of bones. So bones are very important for all kinds of different reasons. All right, so here's a question. What is a hematopoietic tissue? Hematopoietic tissue. It's a tissue that makes red blood cells. Right, right, right. And so if somebody is deficient in hematopoietic tissue, guess what disease they have? Yeah, anemia, for instance, anemia, or could be leukemia as well. Well, leukemia would be a white blood cell disorder. All right. Well, let's talk about cartilage for a little bit. All right, you know three different kinds, right? Hyaline, elastic, fibrocartilage. Hyaline cartilage has chondrocytes and lacunae. It's a little pit. And inside the matrix, we don't see any fibers. So that's why I say submicroscopically. It means that they're so small you can't see them. It's a collagen that's a very soluble form of collagen in the matrix. Parts of your body that are made out of hyaline cartilage are your nose, joint articulations. There is cartilage between the ends of bones so that they don't touch each other. Your ribs have hyaline cartilage. Your larynx is made out of hyaline cartilage. Where's your larynx? You know where your larynx is yet? Larynx. It's like this thing sticking out, your Adam's apple right here, that's part of your larynx. That's hyaline cartilage. And your trachea. That's part of your respiratory system as well. The trachea is the airway between your larynx and your lungs. It has hyaline cartilage in it as well. Okay, elastic. It's similar to hyaline, but it also contains elastic fiber. So it's better able to withstand repeated bending. So there's a part of the larynx called the epiglottis that is important for bending. When you swallow something, it bends all the time. When we get to the digestive system, or actually when we get to the respiratory system, I'll show you where that epiglottis is. And your ear is also made out of elastic cartilage. Right, so your ear can bend, and when you let go, it just goes back to its original location, as long as it isn't pounded so dramatically that those elastic fibers are broken. What do you get? What do you call that ear that's all deformed because of trauma to it? So it would be like a cauliflower ear, right? So it doesn't necessarily go back. If you can over-traumatize something. And then fibrocartilage resists compression. Compression is when you try to squish something. That's a compression force. Tension is the opposite. That's when you try to stretch something. So fibrocartilage can resist squishing as well as pulling apart, compression and tension. Because what's the fiber inside fibrocartilage? You got reticular fibers, you got elastic fibers, and you got collagen. Which one's the strongest?
Collagen.
So fibrocartilage has got collagen in it. And places where we would find that is in the intervertebral discs. Have a ring, which we call the annulus fibrosus, and that just kind of holds the intervertebral discs in position that protect the vertebral bodies. And also, there are menisci in the knee that protect your knee because you have a lot of weight on your knees, a lot of weight of your body going across your knees. All right, so let's see where we have some of these things. Here's a nice chart. So you can see fibrocartilage in red and elastic cartilage in green. And we have hyaline cartilage in kind of a blue. Right, so here you see hyaline cartilage in the rib cage and covering the tips of bones. Okay, what about this nose right here? It's blue, that should be hyaline cartilage. The ear is elastic cartilage. And a couple places where we have fibrocartilage would be the intervertebral discs, the meniscus of the knees. And then also, there's an interesting joint between a couple pubic bones that make up the pelvis right here, or as coxae, or the hip bones. And that's an important joint that's made out of fibrocartilage. Not very movable, but of course during childbirth, right, that fibrocartilage is dissolved away by enzymes, so that allows a little bit of a disarticulation of the hip bones right here to enlarge the birth canal. And then afterwards it sort of grows back together again. Okay, so that's where you see the different kinds of cartilages. Okay, bones. We can classify bones. Is that what's next on our sheet right here? Types of bones? Yeah, let's talk about types of bones. Okay, some bones are long, and they're very short, going from right to left and from anterior to posterior. Right, so they have one dimension that's long compared to other two dimensions. So we call that a long bone. A good example of that will be the bone in, what's this part of the body called right here? That's your arm, okay? Because down between your elbow and your wrist, that is your forearm. Don't forget, that's your forearm. So the arm has got this humerus right here. That's a long bone. Because in the superior inferior direction, it's very long compared to the right, left, or anterior, posterior, it's very short. So this is a typical long bone. And then you see some bones in the hand as well, down over here. This is what we call a phalanges, or a phalanx, one of these bones right here. And that's also a long bone, even though it's what? It's very short, it's very tiny, but it's still long in one dimension and very short in two other dimensions. So those are long bones as well. And of course, the femur is a long bone, the tibia and fibula are long bones. All right, so a long bone just means it's long in one direction. Some bones are flat, like the sternum. All right, so it's long in a right-left dimension, and it's long in a superior-inferior dimension, but in a anterior-posterior dimension, it's going to be very thin. It's a thin bone, so we call it flat. The sternum is a good example of that. Other bones, like this vertebrae right here, are what we call irregular because it's got all kinds of bumps and processes sticking off of it. That's an irregular bone. And then there are short bones, like bones that make up your wrist right here. These are carpals. This is a short bone because it's not really long in any dimension, but it doesn't have a lot of irregularities on it. So probably you should know some examples of these different kinds of bones. Okay, the next thing is we like to use a typical long bone to describe features that we might find on all bones. So let's look at a typical long bone. All right, here's a typical long bone. And you can see that it has two ends. The ends are what we call the epiphyses. And there is one that's closest to some attachment point of your body, so this is the proximal epiphysis. And the one that's farther away is called the distal epiphysis. And notice covering the epiphyses is this blue substance, and that is hyaline cartilage, CT.
Right.
That's part of the skeletal system, but it's cartilage that's on the surface of the bone. So underneath it will be bone. But right there is cartilage, hyaline cartilage. It's just hyaline cartilage. And that hyaline cartilage protects this distal epiphysis from grinding on the other bones that make up the elbow. Right? So it's a nice, it reduces friction, decreases inflammation, and allows the joints to articulate or to move without grinding over each other. All right, on the head of the humerus right here, can you see it like a blue layer right there? There's hyaline over the head of the humerus as well, where it articulates inside the shoulder. All right, so proximal epiphysis, distal epiphysis, and then the part of the bone that's in the middle right here is very tubular in nature, kind of looks like a shaft. So sometimes we call that the shaft of a long bone, but the proper term is diaphysis. Right, so you got the proximal epiphysis, distal epiphysis, and in between the diaphysis. And furthermore, we see a line between the epiphysis and the diaphysis right here. That's really important because before puberty, this part of the bone has cartilage in it. And this is the place where a bone grows in length from. So this sometimes is called a growth plate or an epiphyseal plate. As we reach maturity, that epiphyseal plate ossifies. It turns into bone and produces this epiphyseal line right here. All right, so make sure you know what that epiphyseal plate is all about. And what is a stronger kind of tissue? Is bone stronger or is cartilage stronger? Bone is a lot stronger. So before puberty, this epiphyseal plate is made out of hyaline cartilage, and that can be easily damaged. I know one thing when I was a kid, another thing that I would like to do is get on a swing set and do what? Go higher and higher and then higher and higher. And then when you got real high, what's the really fun thing to do?
Jump,
go flying through the air. That was a lot of fun. But the not so fun part is the landing, right? Because all your bones have this axial compression on them. And when you compress a developing bone axially, you can damage this hyaline cartilage. When that hyaline cartilage is damaged, guess what happens to that bone? It stops growing. So that bone is going to be short. So if you damage one leg and not the other, then you're going to have one leg that's longer than the other one. That's not really all that uncommon. And then you need a lift and a shoe to balance your walking out as a result. Yeah. How they play basketball? I don't know. It's because they want to just play, I think. Okay. But, yeah, no. So, well, you have a genetic predisposition, right, for how tall you're going to be. If both of your parents are tall, chances are you're going to be tall. Both your parents are short, you're going to be short, too. But that's interesting because it tells us that at least within a family, who is typically taller? Is it the men or the women?
Men
typically are taller because guess who reaches maturity sooner, men or women?
Women.
Women, yeah, reach puberty sooner. They mature faster. And when somebody reaches puberty, that's when these epiphyseal plates ossify, they harden over, and that's when you stop growing in tallness. So men take longer, or boys take longer to reach maturity, so their bones grow for an extra year or two before they ossify in those epiphyseal plates. Go away. All right. So I think I talked about that epiphyseal plate pretty much. But you can't always say that men are always going to be taller than women. That's not true, right? But at least maybe within a family, right? Okay. All right. Surrounding every bone is a membrane. We call that the periosteum. And there are cells within the periosteum that allow the bone to grow in diameter. So bone grows in length at the epiphyseal plates. It grows in diameter from the periosteum. Okay, and can you see different kinds of bone? Here is a part, I'm going to really zoom into this area right here. This bone right here, you can see looks like a sponge. Guess what we call that?
Spongy
bone. Here is bone That looks very solid. Guess what we call that? That's what we call, yeah, you could say solid bone, but a better term would be compact bone. So bones are made of these two different kinds, these two different forms. On the surface of the bone is compact bone, and deeper bone is spongy bone. Whenever we look at the surface of an organ, we call that the cortex of that particular organ. And if there's a deeper part to it, we call that the medulla. So for instance, your adrenal gland has a cortical part, we call that the adrenal cortex. There's also has a deeper part, we call that the adrenal medulla. And bones are an organ, and it has cortical bone and medullary bone. So cortical bone, what's another way that we could talk about cortical bone? It is compact bone, and medullary bone is spongy bone. But you know, anywhere, let me see if I can, you see this little layer right here, compact bone?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so if I was going to say where to look for compact bone, it's always within the cortex.
Okay.
It's going to cover the whole cortex. And spongy bone is going to be medullary bone. It's going to be deeper, right? So one is superficial and one is deep. It might not be so thick on the epiphyses right here compared to the diaphysis, but even the epiphyses will have compact bone, at least for a little ways. Okay. Now here is a big hole, a big cavity in the bone. We call that the medullary cavity because where is it? It's deep inside that bone. And that medullary cavity is not just wasted space, it's filled with stuff. And there are two things it can be filled with. Who can remember the two things that can be in this medullary cavity? Yellow marrow or red marrow. And in this particular case, it kind of looks yellow to me, so that is just adipose connective tissue in there. All right, in developing individuals, then this is actually going to be red bone marrow producing red blood cells. So bone marrow is going to be found in this medullary cavity. All right, and just like there's a periosteum that surrounds every surface on the outside, the superficial surface of the bone, there are internal surfaces of the bone, right, that form the cavity and form these inside surfaces of these trabecular plates that make up spongy bone. There's a membrane on these surfaces too, and that's what we call the endosteum. Okay, so the endosteum lines the internal surfaces, the periosteum lines the outside surfaces. Now why do we call it osteum? Because it's a membrane that has something to do with the bone. Anytime you hear osteo, you should automatically think of bone. Yeah. At the periosteum right here. Yep. And on the endosteum, there are cells that break bone down. So these bones, this length of bone right here, or the width of bone, doesn't get thicker and thicker and thicker. It sort of remains the same thickness because this membrane lays bone down, makes bone, and then the endosteum breaks it down so that you have this nice medullary cavity. I'll maybe mention something about that when we look at the osteon. All right, so what did I miss? Oops, going the wrong way, sorry. Okay. All right, what else do we notice about this bone right here? Look at that big blood vessel right there. Bone is highly vascular, has a major blood supply going everywhere to it. That's good and bad. What might be the bad thing? When you break a bone, what's going to happen to it? It's going to bleed a lot. All right, and is a lot of blood loss good for somebody? No, you could die as a result of hemorrhage when you break a bone, especially if it's a big bone like a hip or a femur, maybe even a humerus. Okay, so that, I don't really know too many people in the United States that might die of that, but maybe if you're someplace where there isn't a lot of adequate medical treatment in other places, or if you're really far out up in the mountains someplace, all right, that certainly is a danger for you. All right, but what's the good thing? It will heal very fast. So bone heals very rapidly because it has a very good blood supply. Let's see, what time do we go to? We started at 10:30. Oh, at 12 o'clock. Okay, I remember now. Okay, so a couple more minutes, 5 more minutes or so, right? Okay. So the blood supply goes through the periosteum and it supplies all of the bone cells. Okay, so does this look like a little red dot to you right there? And right there and right there? No? Well, those are blood vessels that go up and down through the whole bone. Okay. All right, so we talked about all this kind of stuff. Sharpie's fibers are fibers that help attach the periosteum to the cortical surface of the bone. Where is that at? You see Sharpie's fibers right in here that attach to the cortical surface of the bone? Yeah, they're just collagen fibers. Okay, so don't forget, cortical bone is very dense. It's made out of what we call a haversian system. We're going to look at that haversian system in just a second. Medullary bone is that spongy bone. Sometimes we call that cancellous bone. That's just another name for it. And trabecular bone, all those bony plates are trabeculae. And in a flat bone, for instance, that make up the skull, that trabecular bone or spongy bone forms what we call diploe. It's just a lattice network inside the bone. All right, so let's look at... So here is a flat bone of the skull. This structure right here, that spongy bone, is what we call diploe.
Is there any reason why it's
spongy? Yes, because if it was solid bone, it would be extremely heavy. So if all the bones in our head were completely filled up with compact bone, I'm not sure we could even lift our heads. It would be so heavy. Okay, so the bone is hollowed out to make it lighter. Guess what kind of animals have very light bones, have a lot of holes in them? They're very, very thin with large medullary cavities. Like birds. Yeah, because they would never get off the ground. All right, if this was solid bone. Okay. So it adds for strength, but yet you don't have to worry about weight. Okay. So if we look at a more microscopic level of a typical long bone, we can see cortical bone over here, and here's some medullary bone. We can see blood vessels moving through what we call perforating canals throughout the whole bone in a right-to-left fashion. We also have blood vessels that go in a superior-inferior direction. All right, so we call this is the central canal of something we call an osteon. And what do you see when you look at this osteon right here? You see a lot of rings. You see a ring inside of another ring, inside of another ring, inside of another ring. And that's what gives bone a lot of strength in terms of compression. Right? So we could take a big stack of books, and if we had a straw, a really thin straw made out of plastic, and as long as we didn't bend the straw, we could probably have that one straw hold up all those books. Right, because a tube is very strong. It's an architecturally very, very strong kind of structure. It resists compression. And so, how is a bone made? It's made out of tubes, inside tubes, inside tubes. And then what do you have going around all of these tubes? You have even more tubes going around them. And so that gives bone a tremendous amount of strength. And the funny thing about a tube, if you ever study mechanical engineering, is that the strength of the tube for compression, the strength increases as the thickness of the wall gets thinner and thinner and thinner. So the bone as a tube, the diaphysis can't be one thick tube because it would not be very strong. It's made out of what? Thousands of very thin tubes all put together, tubes inside tubes, and so bones really don't ever compress until it receives severe amount of trauma. All right, so I guess we're going to have to start here next time. But before you go, where's that sign-in sheet at? Because don't forget, this is disaster drill week. Everybody's got to sign in. Wave that sign-in sheet around someplace. Everybody should sign the sign-in sheet, because if you don't, I don't know if you're here. You're counted as absent if you don't sign. That's what the syllabus says. Okay? So let's look at Which one?